We've been in the Elijah and Elisha cycle all summer. Last week, Elijah was taken to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha is his appointed successor. And so this is an Elisha story. Except, first of all, we meet a very important person called Naaman. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man and in high favor with his master because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man, though a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. Now, the Arameans, on one of their raids, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he'd cure us of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord just what the girl from the land of Israel had said, and the king of Aram said, "Well, go then, and I'll send along a letter to the king of Israel." And he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, and the letter read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I sent you my servant Naaman, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read that letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to give death or life that this man sends word to me and to cure this man of his leprosy? Just look and see. He's trying to pick a fight with me." But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent a message to the king. "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come to me. He'll learn that there's a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and halted at the entrance to Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored and you shall be clean." But Naaman became angry and went away saying, "Well, I thought that for me, he'd surely come out and stand and call on the name of his Lord, his God, and wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Havana and Farfar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" And he turned and he went away in a rage. But his servants approached him and said, "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more then, when all he said to you was wash and be clean?" So he went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy, and he was clean. Let's pray. God, be in my speaking and be in the listening, that together what we do right now will glorify your name. Amen. Remember the little girl from the start of that reading? So Naaman is a big shot Syrian commander. And on one of his raids in Israel, the army had taken captive a little girl. And he had taken her home, and she was serving as a maid to his wife. That little girl's not even given a name. The way I think about it, the person without a name is no person at all, so I've called her Anna. And I hope one day I'm going to meet her in heaven. And then she can tell me her real name, among other things. Until then, that's what I'm going to call her. And I call this sermon Anna Power because of her and on the strength of her word, Naaman, the mighty army commander, Naaman, the powerful and rich, highly placed man who is in a position to get a letter of reference from the king. Because of this trial, Naaman is willing to transcend cultural and religious barriers and open himself to wholeness. And that is amazing. I'll tell you in a minute how amazing I think that is. But for now, my question is, can we open ourselves today to the power, to Anna power, that makes terribly important people willing to let go of themselves long enough to cross over to another person's world, and in the crossing, encounter a truth and a wholeness never dreamed possible? Because of that little kid who is, you can't have more strikes against you than she has. She's a slave. She's a foreigner. She's a woman. She's a child. Lowest of the low and totally without power. Because of that kid, a man's life is saved. And on her word, he's willing to let go of status and prestige, not right away, of course, because that's not how that works, but enough to let in the possibility that his truth is not the only truth, and that his ways are not ultimate, and that his power is not the only power. And what has to happen before someone's willing to do that? We have to find that. The Spirit of God moving in such a way that even those of us who cling to what we think is power are willing to let go just enough to encounter the living God. We need Anna power, the Spirit of God moving us away from any claims to power except those of the living God. We need it in our world, we need it in our church, we need it in ourselves. And that we should receive that power ought to be our prayer. That we might be vehicles of this power for others would be our humble prayer toward faithfulness, and to become like her, to be able to point others, even our enemies and captors, toward God who alone can bring wholeness. There could be no loftier aspiration. We couldn't hope to live better than that. We're going to walk through this story once again. So Naaman, you gathered, is an important man. He's commander of the Syrian army, second in command only to the Syrian king. And Syria was a major world power, and so Naaman is an important man. He's used to leading. When he speaks, people listen. People fear and respect him. He has thousands of soldiers under him. He's been victorious in battle. They threw a huge ticker tape parade when at the time he was the time of Syria's man of the year 5 times in a row, like that. A hero. He's brave, he's rich, he's smart and powerful. Naaman was an important man. And he was a leper. What you need to know is that leprosy was dreaded. It made you unclean and outcast. There were all kinds of moral failures associated with it, sort of like when AIDS was first in the, it was for those people. So for all people, Naaman, to have leprosy, well, one thing is it changed some people's minds about leprosy, and donations for leprosy research rose dramatically in Damascus, and it became fashionable for stars and public people to wear pink leprosy ribbons, and several telephones were staged, and the Syrian public TV had documentaries on the disease and its consequences. Naaman had leprosy, and all his money and power and prestige and honors were useless to him. It's a personal crisis. And I don't know if you've ever gone through a personal crisis like that or watched someone else do so. Come to the conclusion that the thing you thought gave you power is really, in the end, quite powerless. That's not an easy thing to deal with. It expresses itself often in intense anger and sometimes depression, sometimes a frantic chasing after more and more of the very thing that has betrayed you. It may be trite to say that we as a society in what was once called the first world are going through that very thing now. And in the church, certainly the mainline denominations in North America and Europe, are experiencing something very like that. A confrontation with the fact that the things we counted on to give us importance and influence and power and even meaning are really, in the end, not serving us. So Naaman the Great is a leper. At home, his wife, who apparently is also nameless, has a little girl as a maid. They got her in Israel when Naaman and his army had raided that country. They captured her and brought her back to work as a slave girl at Naaman's home, maid for his wife. So there's that. Who knows what the atmosphere in that home has been like since Naaman has been ill? And who knows if this little girl was used to speaking up to her mistress or not, but she suggests that there is a prophet in her home country who might be able to help. And Naaman listened. That he did is witness either to his desperation or to the fact that maybe she had proved wise and helpful in the past. I don't know. Whatever reason, he listens. And so he goes to the king. The king also reacts favorably. He doesn't want to lose this valuable member of his power base. So he tells Naaman to go, kind of treats it like a diplomatic opportunity or something, gives him a letter of introduction or of reference to give to the king of Israel, whose country he had recently trashed. I don't know how he felt that was going to go, but okay. So Naaman leaves. Has he yet received the message that all his power and riches aren't going to get him anywhere yet? No. He goes to he takes 10 suits of clothing and 6,000 chariots. He takes a bunch of stuff, an entourage, and he sets off. He is not flying economy class. And at the airport, there's a limo and a red carpet and security guards. And this trip to Israel is quite a thing. So let me just stop for a minute and point out that this is quite a come down for Naaman. He's the commander of the army that has been clobbering Israel, which in his eyes is a tiny, two-bit consequence bit of land, good for connecting trade routes. And he's lowering himself to ask for the help of this country on the strength and advice of a child. It must have been a hard trip to make. But he takes a deep breath and puts on his uniform and all his medals and squares back his shoulders and swallows his pride and goes, making as much of a show to bolster his self-esteem as he can. And the king of Israel reacts fearfully and defensively. It's got to be some kind of a trick. He thinks, I can't cure anyone of leprosy. He's trying to pick a fight. He's going to use this as an excuse to invade again. And Elisha, the prophet, Elisha says to the king, calm down, it's not a trick, send him to me. So Naaman, clearly not thrilled by his reception so far, is sent away from the palace and over to Elisha's house. I don't think he's living next door either. Why couldn't Elisha come to the palace to him? No, come to me, he says. So Naaman has to go to him, but he's come this far so he can suffer one more indignity, and he gets together his horses and his chariots and his whole entourage and makes the trip through town to Elisha's house. And Elisha doesn't even bother to come to the door and meet him. Doesn't ask him in or even talk with him. He sends a messenger to the door. The messenger says, Elisha says, go wash in the Jordan. Well, Naaman couldn't believe that that was the last straw. As if the disease were not pain enough, he had suffered indignity and insult and humiliation in his country, and this was too much. Doesn't this prophet know who I am? I'm Naaman, the Syrian commander-in-chief of the army, second-in-command to the king. And this little Israelite prophet, who probably can't read and has no manners, hasn't the decency to come to me, now sends a servant to tell me to wash in the Jordan River. And now you've seen the Jordan River. It's a trickle, it's a brook, it's a muddy, swampy, knee-deep creek. We have rivers. We've got big rivers in Syria. If I wanted to go swimming, I would have stayed home. Who does he think he is? And this is no ordinary illness. No, I'm Naaman. When I'm sick, I need specialists. I need brand new medicines. And I need healers who do something, like wave your hand, something, do something. And he stomped off in a huff. When it was a little safer, his servant said, if he had asked you to do something difficult, would you have done that? So, when it's an easy thing, why don't you just try it? And he did. He went and he immersed himself in the Jordan 7 times, it says. And the narrator tells us he was made whole. Isn't that a great story? That's a great story. Do you know a few Naamans? Maybe you're one yourself, I don't know. But it's very true to human nature and to life. I've got a couple of questions. Anna, the little slave girl, remember her? She tends to get lost as the story goes on. Anna has been abducted from her family and enslaved in a foreign land, and that's a whole sermon in itself. She could have kept quiet and let him die. Instead, she helped her captor. I don't know if you've ever been in a position of having a chance to do a good thing for someone who's done a bad thing to you. Did you or would you? Do you think Naaman understood what that cost her, maybe? What do you think happened when they all got home? The Bible tells story after story when the God of Israel healed and welcomed and used and supported people of other cultures and other religions. These narratives have layers upon layers that are not apparent on the first read-through. I have a question about the Annas of our own world right now. And we can laugh at Naaman, but he listened to a kid. If you've not heard of a young girl called Autumn Pelche, she is a 13-year-old Anishinaabe girl. Google her and her address to the United Nations as a water advocate. And Greta Thunberg, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, from Sweden. I'll just quote her a bit. She's 16, and she too addressed the United Nations on climate change. Just a couple of quotes from her. I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic and to act as if the house was on fire, because it is. And there are her quotes. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their eyes. More locally, the young people who have been protesting and advocating for action on climate change here in Whitehorse. 12-year-old Sophie Moga. "You will die of old age," she says. "I will die of climate change." 12-year-old Sylvie Sandiford. "I think they should definitely ban plastic bags and do just as much as they can to stop all this from happening." And on it goes. And I am more than aware that this sermon and this whole service is being led by a senior citizen when it could have been led by youth. My only excuse for that is, have you ever tried to get a hold of kids in the summer? But I want you to know that I'm not unaware of that sad irony. My final question today is this: how do we get Anna Powell? Can we become like Anna, ready to point people, even our enemies, to a source of life? A lot of people are bemoaning the loss of the church's power in society. We aren't the force we once were, that's for sure. People, for the most part, don't pay attention when the church speaks. Governments certainly don't care what we think or say. We've lost a great deal of power, and we don't have big budgets anymore, we don't have people power anymore, and we don't have influence anymore. And the kindest thing to say about how people on the streets see us is that they see us as irrelevant. More often than not, they see us as the source of the problems. And we're moving, I'm just suggesting, is that a paradigm that works for you? We've moved from being Naaman to being Anna. And we exist now in a situation where overwhelmingly people around us don't share our beliefs or even know what they are, or worse still, assume what we believe from what they heard on Facebook. Overwhelmingly, we are without power. We're weak. That's how God works. That's how God works. That's a Jesus model. To know where real power lies and to be able to point to it when people are ready to hear, to be able to speak in a way that frees people, to be willing, as Naaman did, to swallow his pride, drop the pretense, and step into the Jordan, admitting that there may be another way to live and speak so that people are open to cross-cultural and religious barriers in search of truth and wholeness. That's real power. That's Anna power. If the church could be Anna, I think we'd be faithful indeed. May God bless you as you think about these things. Amen.